in China?
Well, first and foremost, I'm declaring war on the word tariff. And again, I just, given the confusion that word creates, I don't understand how any reporter could in good faith use the term, or at least without adding in parentheses taxes on imports, because it's not a difficult concept. And again, I'm an economist. I know what a tariff is. You know, obviously, many people do know what a tariff is, but the point is a lot of people don't. So taxes on imports, taxes on imports, taxes on imports. When Donald Trump says he wants the tariff, someone is saying he wants to put a tax on the goods we import from them. That's what he's doing. And that's not an arguable point. That's simply definitional. So that's one thing front and center. The second thing, I really wish people would understand what's at stake. And again, the reporting, I think, does not do a good job of it. So when we talk about putting taxes on the imports, particularly with China, that we're making items that would otherwise be available to us relatively low cost at ridiculously high cost. So again, that cars first and foremost, but we're dealing with the batteries from China, a lot of other things. If we're concerned about global warming, we should want to see this technology spread as quickly as possible. I wrote a piece on this a while back. So let's say that the U.S. had a plan to subsidize the adoption of clean technologies around the world. Well, we all applaud that when we say that was a great thing. Well, China's doing that, and we're treating them like it's an act of war. So, again, I'm sympathetic to auto workers. I have a lot of friends over the years who are auto workers, and I respect enormously the union, the United Auto Workers as a union, but it's not an act of war for them to make low-cost cars available to us. And just the third thing, when we talk about protectionism, I've made this point many, many times over the years, the most extreme protectionism we have are patent and copyright protections. Mm-hmm. These are government-granted monopolies. Now, I understand they're policies for a specific purpose. They promote innovation. They promote creative work. Understood. But they're policies. They're protectionism. They're not the market. And that's something we should always be aware of in trade and other areas, because even domestically. But we're raising the price of items that are protected enormously and treating this as just the market. So drugs that cost thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars, almost invariably they cost $10, $20, $30 in the absence of patent protection. And people should understand that this is a really big deal. It's a big intervention in the market and also a huge source of inequality. I like to make the joke Bill Gates would still be working for a living. He probably gained Social Security now as an old guy, but he'd probably still be working for a living if the government didn't threaten to arrest anyone who copies Microsoft software without his permission. And it really does make a big difference, and it's literally never discussed. So those are some items. I can give you a longer list, but those would be my starting point.
All right, then. Well, we'll pause at your starting point, but just for now. We've been speaking with Dean Baker, co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find their work and Dean's Beat the Press commentary at CPER.net. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among many other things, 2024 was a series of reminders that corporate news media, tasked primarily with enriching the rich and shoring up entrenched institutions, will not, today or ever, do the liberatory, illuminating work of independent reporting that boldly speaks truth to power, that stands up for the societally voiceless, that provides space for the debates and discussions we need to move society forward, for those of us that believe that U.S. society needs to change. New calendar years are symbolic, sure, but they can also offer a metaphorical fresh start. why not see 2025 as a much-needed opportunity to acknowledge, support, create, and grow independent journalism? We'll talk about that today with two people who are and have been doing not just critical, dissident, uplifting journalism, but the thinking and advocating around why we need it and the role it can play. Sonali Kolhatkar from Rising Up with Sonali and Laura Flanders from Laura Flanders and Friends. They're coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Since Pete Hegseth was nominated to head the Department of Defense, his nomination has raised concerns from extremism experts, just based on the things that he's said publicly, in podcasts, on his Fox News show, on social media, and in his writings. He's published numerous books, including one in which he suggests that factional violence between the left and the right in the U.S. is inevitable.
Pete Hegseth, Trump's Pentagon pick, sparks alarm over far-right extremism. We'll speak with Guardian reporter Alice Herman on this first day of confirmation hearings for Defense Secretary. Then as Gaza ceasefire talks heat up, outgoing President Joe Biden defends his foreign policy.
The Palestinian people deserve peace and the right to determine their own future. Israel deserves peace and real security. And the hostages and their families deserve to be reunited. And so we're working urgently to close this deal.
We'll speak with Matt Duss in Jerusalem, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. His recent column, Democrats have become the party of war. Americans are tired of it. Then global pressure mounts for Israel to release Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of the pediatric Kamal Adwan Hospital.
Some of people who have been recently released just say something about my father, and they told that he has been tortured severely by the Israelis, and he was transferred to another prison.
We'll speak with a pediatrician who collaborated with Dr. Abu Safia to establish a feeding center in Gaza last year. And finally, how you can help the incarcerated firefighters battling LA wildfires. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Qatar's foreign ministry says Israel and Hamas are closer to reaching a ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza than at any time in the past. For the first time, delegations from Israel and Hamas are in the same building in Doha for negotiations, but they're not holding direct talks. Envoys of both President Biden and President-elect Trump are in Doha as well. On Monday, Biden spoke about the ceasefire talks in the final foreign policy speech of his presidency.
The war between Israel and Hamas, we're on the brink of a proposal that I laid out in detail months ago, finally coming to fruition.
Just last week, Biden notified Congress of a new $8 billion arms sale to Israel. In Israel, two far-right members of Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, have spoken out against a possible hostage deal, with Ben-Gvir threatening to quit if a deal is reached. Meanwhile, Israel's continuing its assault on Gaza. Earlier today, an Israeli airstrike hit a home east of Khan Yunis, killing at least nine Palestinians, including women and children. Ala al-Qadi lost his brother in the attack.
As you may know, he was a displaced. We were displaced from Rafah, and he was staying with his in-laws. He was martyred along with his relatives, his brothers-in-law, wife, and his 20 days old newborn baby. Just today, we were scheduled to visit my father. We were saying, thank God, there will be a ceasefire, and we will all go back to Rafah. But my brother was not destined to return.
Meanwhile, Israel has killed another Palestinian journalist in Gaza, Alam Al-Nafet, who recently reported from the besieged Indonesian hospital for Dropsite News and other outlets. In a statement, Dropsite News said, quote, through her words and images, she ensured that atrocities which might have been silenced were brought to light, allowing the world to witness the brutal reality unfolding there, unquote. Alam al-Nafet was killed as she was walking to Al-Shifa Hospital. In other news from Gaza, Palestinian fighters killed 5 Israeli soldiers in Beit Hanun in the northern Gaza Strip on Monday. 10 other soldiers were wounded. Nawaf Salam, the president of the International Court of Justice at The Hague, has been named Lebanon's new prime minister. He served on the ICJ since 2017. On Monday, Salam received the backing of majority of lawmakers in Beirut. This comes less than a week after Lebanese lawmakers picked Joseph Aoun to be Lebanon's new president. The Los Angeles region is bracing for another 2 days of high winds that could bring what's been described as, quote, explosive fire growth. The National Weather Service predicts wind gusts up to 65 miles an hour. This comes as fire crews continue to battle the Palisades and Eaton fires and smaller blazes. A new fire in Ventura County burned 55 acres Monday. Over the past week, the fires have killed at least 24 people and left over 12,000 homes and other buildings destroyed or damaged. Meanwhile, a number of residents of Altadena have filed lawsuits against Southern California Edison. The devastating Eaton fire began in an area where witnesses say they saw sparks coming from the company's electrical lines. We'll have more on the fires later in the broadcast, speaking specifically about incarcerated firefighters. The Justice Department has released special counsel Jack Smith's report detailing what he called Donald Trump's, quote, criminal efforts to retain power after losing the 2020 election. In the report, Smith said there was enough evidence to convict Trump, but that proceeding with the prosecution became impossible after Trump was elected 2 months ago. Smith wrote, quote, the department's view that the Constitution prohibits the continued indictment and prosecution of a president is categorical and does not turn on the gravity of the crimes charged, the strength of the government's proof, or the merits of the prosecution, which the office stands fully behind, unquote. Smith went on to write, quote, indeed, but for Mr. Trump's election and imminent return to the presidency, the office assessed that the admissible evidence was sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction at trial, unquote. The Justice Department has not yet released a second part of Smith's report that covers his investigation into Trump's mishandling of classified documents. The Senate Armed Services Committee is holding its confirmation hearing today for Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump's pick to become defense secretary. The New Yorker magazine has revealed several Republican senators refused to meet with the woman who accused Hegseth of raping her at a Republican women's conference in Monterey, California in 2017. The FBI also did not talk to the woman, as well as other possible sources, including one of Hegseth's former wives or former employees of Concerned Veterans for America. Hegseth was forced out from the group over accusations of financial mismanagement, sexual misconduct, and public drunkenness. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer reports Hegseth's supporters have intimidated potential witnesses from speaking out against the former Fox News host. Mayer also reveals a group of conservative billionaires, including Bill Koch and Richard Uihlein, plan to spend $1 million to pressure Republican senators to support Hegseth. Confirmation hearings for Interior Secretary nominee Doug Burgum and Veterans Affairs Secretary nominee Doug Collins were scheduled for today, but have been postponed over paperwork, it said. The New York Times is reporting Donald Trump is expected to give Elon Musk, the world's richest man, office space in the White House complex to run the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Musk, who has billions of dollars in government contracts, was the largest financial backer of Trump's campaign, has been regularly seen by his side at Mar-a-Lago since the election. Meanwhile, tensions growing between Musk and former Trump advisor Steve Bannon. In a recent interview with an Italian newspaper, Bannon vowed to, quote, get Elon Musk kicked out, unquote, of Trump's inner circle. Bannon said, quote, he is a truly evil guy, a very bad guy, unquote. Bannon has criticized Musk's support of the H-1B visa program used by many tech companies to hire foreign-born workers. A federal judge has ordered the white supremacist group Patriot Front and its leader to pay some $2.8 million in damages for violating the civil rights of a black musician who was attacked by Patriot Front members in Boston's Back Bay in 2022. The attackers approached Charles Murrell as he was headed to perform at a July 4th event, pinned him to a lamppost, and kicked and punched him. They were also heard using a racist slur against Murrell. In the UK, two members of the direct action climate group Just Stop Oil were arrested after they spray painted the words 1.5 is dead on the grave of Charles Darwin at London's Westminster Abbey Monday. The protest follows the news last week that 2024 was the hottest year in human history, with the average global temperature rising by 1.6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This is one of the activists.
2024 was the hottest year on record. We have already passed through the 1.5 degree that was supposed to keep us safe. Millions are being displaced. California is on fire, and three quarters of all wildlife has disappeared since the 1970s.
The activist later said she believed Charles Darwin would approve of their protest, quote, because he would be following the science and he would be as upset as us with the government for ignoring the science, unquote. President Biden announced federal student debt cancellation for another 150,000 borrowers Monday. The relief targets students who are defrauded by their institutions, people with permanent disabilities, and public service workers. The latest move brings the Biden administration's total student debt relief to some $183 billion for over 5 million borrowers. Student debt activists have been urging Biden to use all legal tools at his disposal to cancel more loans before Trump takes office, including for the most vulnerable debtors, such as older people. The far-right dominated Supreme Court in 2023 blocked Biden's plan that would have cut up to $20,000 in debt for over 40 million people each. And the youngest of the Freedom Riders, Charles Person, has died at 82. Person was one of 13 original Freedom Riders that risked their lives, frequently coming under violent attack as they traveled across the South at the height of the civil rights era to fight against segregated interstate bus services. Charles Person was just 18, a freshman at Morehouse College, when he joined the Freedom Riders movement, boarding a New Orleans-bound Trailways bus in Washington May 4, 1961. Though the original journey was cut short after the Freedom Riders were repeatedly brutalized, including by Klansmen, it inspired hundreds of others to join the bus desegregation movement, ramping up political pressure on the Kennedy administration. Interstate buses and terminals were desegregated later that year in November. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The confirmation hearing for President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth begins today amidst backlash over his history of sexual assault, misusing funds in his previous positions, possible ties to white nationalists, and various violations committed while under the influence of alcohol. The hearing is expected to be contentious, but Democrats do not have the votes in the Senate to kill the nomination. Two other confirmation hearings set for today were delayed due to missing background paperwork. Trump's pick for Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins and Interior nominee Governor Doug Burgum. Pete Hegseth is a former Fox News host, a military veteran. Democrats say the FBI's background check failed to fully interview key witnesses, including Hegseth's ex-wife. The New York Times reports she, quote, made multiple attempts to contact the Bureau for a more substantive discussion, but her calls were not returned, unquote. The New Yorker's Jane Mayer reports Hegseth supporters have sought to intimidate potential witnesses from speaking out against him. Mayer also revealed a group of conservative billionaires, including Bill Koch and Richard Uihlein, plan to spend $1 million to pressure Republican senators to support Hegseth. Jane Mayer previously reported Hegseth was forced out of leadership roles at two veterans groups for misusing funds, sexually harassing women, and being repeatedly drunk on the job. In one incident, Hegseth drunkenly chanted, kill all Muslims, at a bar in 2015. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports Hegseth's own mother once accused him of mistreating women. Hegseth has been a vocal opponent of the Pentagon's embrace of multiculturalism and the Pentagon's decision to allow women to serve in combat. He laid out his views on the Sean Ryan show in November.
You don't like women in combat?
No.
Why not?
I love women service members who contribute amazingly because everything about men and women serving together makes the situation more complicated and complication in combat. Mm-hmm. Means casualties are worse. Mm-hmm. And when you actually go into the hood, again, and I, you know, I got response. I've got 99% positive response to this. A little bit of pushback. But when you actually break down what they did in the studies to open the door for women in combat, I mean, they just ignored them.
Meanwhile, CBS News reports Hegseth was one of 12 National Guard members removed as guards for President Biden's 2021 inauguration over possible white nationalist extremist ties. Hegseth has tattoos associated with the white supremacist and neo-Nazi movements, including what's known as a Jerusalem cross, a symbol used by Christian nationalists. For more, we're joined by Alice Herman, politics and democracy reporter for The Guardian. Her piece is headlined, Pete Hegseth, Trump's Pentagon Pick, Sparks Alarm Over Far-Right Extremism. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alice. Why don't you start off by just laying out what you know about Pete Hegseth on this first day of his confirmation hearing?
Thank you so much for having me. Shortly after Trump picked Pete Hegseth for his nominee to head the Defense Department, I was hearing from expert sources on far-right extremism that there were things about Hegseth in his kind of public appearances, from the tattoos that he has inked on his body to statements that he's made in podcasts and on Fox News, to the multiple books that he's published, that kind of raised alarm bells about possible ties to extremist groups, or at least a kind of affiliation or ideological alignment with the far right. And so my reporting on Hegseth has focused mostly on those sort of public statements that he's made and the ways that he, you know, presents himself on social media, from the content that he's putting out there to the things that he's saying, like I said, on podcasts and on the show that he used to host on Fox News. What we know is that he really gives the impression of kind of a hyper-masculine MAGA crusader, and he uses the term crusades himself, seemingly from a fascination with the crusades. We know that he has a tattoo sleeve that features at least two tattoos that experts in white nationalism and the far right identified pretty quickly as being symbols that people on the far right, including neo-Nazi groups, have used themselves. You know, we can get more into some of the things that he's written in his books, but there's a lot out there. And I think kind of the point that I want to make here is that in addition to the really great investigative work that has been done, you know, looking into accusations of sexual assault by Pete Hegseth to, you know, like you described, allegations of drunkenness at the workplace. He also has this very public kind of persona that will likely be, you know, interrogated during his Senate confirmation hearings today.
I wanted to go back to Pete Hegseth in his own words, speaking on the Sean Ryan show about why he was deemed to be an extremist by the military.
I was deemed an extremist because of a tattoo by my National Guard unit in Washington, D.C. And my orders were revoked to guard the Biden inauguration. When I was writing the book, I reached out to somebody in the unit who could confirm with 99.9% certainty, because he was on in the meetings and on the emails. Nope, someone inside the D.C. Guard trolled your social media, found a tattoo, used it as an excuse to call you a white nationalist, an extremist, and you were specifically by name orders revoked to guard the inauguration because you were considered a potential threat.
How is that? It's a cross.
It's a Christian symbol.
Your response, Alice Herman.
Sure. So the two tattoos that, you know, that researchers and experts and historians kind of pointed to as like a red flag for extremism were the Jerusalem cross tattoo that he has on his chest and the words Deus Vult that he has tattooed on his bicep. Deus Vult means God wills it in Latin, and both are rooted in the Crusades, and both are widely popular among, neither are widely popular among Christians today, but they're both associated with far right and neo-Nazi groups, which have used the symbols. And so, of course, Hegseth can claim some plausible deniability, like not every single person who takes an interest in the Crusades or an interest in one of these symbols is necessarily affiliated with a far right group. But given the fact that he has both, the scholars and historians that I spoke with felt that that seemed to indicate at the very least an alliance or an ideological kind of alignment with white nationalist and Christian nationalist subcultures.
I wanted to go to the part of the article where you write much of Hegseth's social media content is promotional. He regularly advertises an ammunition company, a coffee company, and the pro-gun group Right to Bear on Instagram. In November 2023, he promoted an Advent songbook published by the Forge Press, which is described on his website as an organization that arms Christians with weapons to build, defend, and expand the new Christendom. Talk more about this.
Sure. So, yeah, if you look through his, and from what I can tell, he hasn't, he and his team, whoever's, kind of helping him prepare for this confirmation hearing, hasn't changed his social media presence, at least from what I can tell. And so if you look through, like, his Instagram account, you can see that he spends a lot of time advertising for a pro-gun coffee company. He advertises for a company that sells silencers for guns. He advertises, like you mentioned, for a company called the Forge Press, which is a Christian nationalist company that has a podcast, and they also sell merch, you know, things like hats that say Make America Christian Again and things like that. And so, you know, you can always kind of get a sense of the ideological leanings of a content creator based on who they're platforming and who they're promoting.
And his position on women in the military, I mean, he's going to be before people like Senator Tammy Duckworth, whose legs were blown off in Iraq. You have Elizabeth Warren, who's just written a multi-page, 33-page report, case against Hegseth on this issue, women in the military, on his campaign against so-called woke generals to throw them out of office, you know, clean house.
Yeah, that's right. So in his 2024 book, which is called War on Warriors, he says that the military, well, first, he kind of opens his book with an anecdote that you described earlier about the military allegedly not, the army not calling on him to serve during Biden's inauguration amid concerns about the tattoos that we had discussed. And then he goes on to, you know, write about how he doesn't think that the military should be focused on or even engaging in rooting out extremism within the ranks. And he locates diversity, equity, and inclusion principles in the military as a problem. He sees efforts to promote women and people of color and LGBT people in the military as extremely problematic, and he suggests that the promotion of minorities within the ranks is the result of preferential treatment and not merit. And he speaks this writes pretty disparagingly about women and LGBT people and people of color in the military in that book. It's one of his central claims.
You speak with a number of historians who say purging generals constitutes a coup.
Yeah, he in that same book, he proposes purging woke, in his words, woke generals from the military as a solution to this problem that he identifies or that he claims the military has with embracing, like I said, DEI principles. And it's true that the historians that I spoke with described that as being tantamount to a coup.
Finally, what does the military gain by having him at the helm? As one senator pointed out, he hasn't been in charge of any group larger than 40 people, his platoon. We're talking about 3 million people in the military.
I think that the Trump administration would stand to gain a loyalist, and even in the transition zone communications, they've emphasized his total alignment with Trump's vision and loyalty to Trump. So I think that is what the military stands to gain if he is confirmed.
Alice Herman, we want to thank you for being with us, politics and democracy reporter for The Guardian. We'll link to your piece, Pete Hegseth, Trump's Pentagon Pick Sparks Alarm Over Far-Right Extremism. We'll revisit this hearing tomorrow after the first day of confirmation hearings today. Next up, as Gaza ceasefire talks continue, we'll look at President Joe Biden's defense of his foreign policy in his major State Department address yesterday. We'll go to Jerusalem to speak with Matt Duss, former foreign policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders. Stay with us. Sankofa Visions by Charles M. Murrell III. On Monday, a federal judge ordered the white supremacist group Patriot Front and its leader to pay the musician some $2.8 million for attacking him in Boston in 2022. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As Gaza ceasefire talks continue, and less than a week before President Donald Trump takes office, outgoing President Joe Biden defended his foreign policy in a major address at the State Department yesterday, where he was met by protesters with signs that read, "Biden's policy is genocide." In his speech on Monday, Biden said his administration spearheaded a ceasefire plan that the UN Security Council approved in June, even as he continued to provide Israel with weapons, and claimed to be, quote, on the brink of a proposal I laid out months ago, he said.
We're pressing hard to close this. The deal we have structured would free the hostages, halt the fighting, provide security to Israel, and allow us to significantly surge humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians who suffered terribly in this war that Hamas started. They've been through hell. So many innocent people have been killed. So many communities have been destroyed. The Palestinian people deserve peace. and the right to determine their own futures. Israel deserves peace and real security, and the hostages and their families deserve to be reunited. And so we're working urgently to close this deal.
Biden also touted his administration's role gaining NATO support for Ukraine after Russia's 2022 invasion, and defended the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021 after two decades of occupation. For more, we go to Jerusalem. We're joined by Matt Duss, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. His new piece for The Guardian, Democrats have become the party of war. Americans are tired of it. Matt, welcome back to Democracy Now! Respond to President Biden's address.
Well, I think looking at as a whole, I mean, I think there are things that President Biden can claim credit for in his foreign policy. The break from the neoliberal economic order, a new approach to economics that invests in jobs and American manufacturing, that has important domestic and foreign policy implications. I think his work defending Brazilian democracy is something that's not mentioned enough. He very likely helped avert a coup against Lula in Brazil. And I do think he can claim some credit for rallying allies for, you know, the defense of Ukraine against Russia's invasion. On the other hand, and I do think this is what his foreign policy will be remembered for, is Gaza. There's just no other way to look at it. I think being here in Israel and Palestine and Jerusalem, I've traveled in the West Bank talking to Israelis and Palestinians. There is a lot of anger, of course, at Hamas and at Benjamin Netanyahu, but there's also a great bit of anger at Joe Biden himself for not applying enough pressure on Netanyahu to get this deal, which, let's remember, Joe Biden announced this proposed deal back in May. Months have passed. Tens of thousands of people, more people have been killed, more lives have been destroyed, more Israeli hostages have been killed. So I think there's a great deal of anger for him here, and I think that's going to impact American foreign policy and in this region around the world, too.
Matt, you are in Jerusalem. You're usually in Washington, D.C. Why are you there?
I'm here with some colleagues, just as I said, speaking with Israelis, with Palestinians, members of the governments, analysts, journalists, activists, and regular citizens, just to try and get a sense of what people are thinking and feeling here as we see the handover between, you know, from Biden to Trump. What are people's fears? What are their hopes? Just to kind of share those perspectives with colleagues back at home and to better inform the conversation.
And where have you gone?
We've been in Ramallah. We've been in Jerusalem. We'll be in the West Bank later today. Earlier this morning, my colleagues and I visited one of the communities near Gaza that was attacked on October 7. We're able to see some of the sites of these attacks, talk to members of this community. It is hard to talk about. I mean, what happened on that day, I think everyone understands, was unspeakable. That pain is still very, very real in these communities and in Israel, as well as the pain of what is happening in Gaza amongst Palestinians. There's great anticipation for the end of this war, great anticipation for the release of Palestinian prisoners that would be part of this hostage release and ceasefire deal. But I do want to relate something I heard from a member of one of the kibbutzes that were attacked on October 7. He understands that this war is doing no good. He wants the ceasefire. He wants the hostages released. He wants Palestinian civilians to stop being killed. And I think that is a message that President Biden has not heard loud enough, very tragically.
Matt Duss, you write in your piece, Biden showed that international law is little more than a cudgel to be used against our enemies while being treated as optional for our friends. Explain.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at Biden's approach to Ukraine and compare that to his approach to the Gaza war, the contrast could not be starker. I think in helping rally to the defense of Ukraine, President Biden and his administration articulated a very, you know, strong set of principles of international law, the right of countries to be sovereign and defend their own borders, how to defend themselves against invasion. At the same time, we see Israel, even though Israel, of course, had the right to respond to October 7 and prevent such an attack from happening again, the tactics it's been using in Gaza have violated almost every protection of civilians. It has violated many of the same rules of war that Russia has been violating in Ukraine, and for which Russia has been rightly condemned. And yet we hear, you know, month after month after month, over a year now, nothing like that condemnation. In fact, no condemnation whatsoever from President Biden. In fact, continuing not only to not condemn them, but continuing to send a massive flow of arms that is facilitating this mass slaughter in Gaza. And I think many Americans understand that, and I can guarantee people around the world understand that. Many who have questions about what is this so-called international order that President Biden is talking about when we see the stark disparity between Ukraine and Gaza.
I wanted to go to a headline just last week, the Biden administration announcing new sanctions against Sudan's rapid support forces after including the paramilitary group committed genocide. And it goes on to say that Secretary of State Tony Blinken said he'd made the determination after reviewing the horrifying information suffering inside Sudan. More than half the population faces crisis level hunger. The New York Times reports Biden administration had been reluctant to admit that the rapid support forces were committing genocide in Sudan for fear it would highlight Biden's refusal to make the same determination about Israel's killing of Palestinians in Gaza. Matt.
I think that fear is well founded. Well, I'm glad to see that determination, and our organization welcomed it. I think a lot of people were happy to see that the administration calling this for what it is. He should be willing to call out these same crimes being carried out against the people of Gaza. Even if he's unwilling to use the word genocide, there are any number of other words and terms that he can use: crimes against humanity, atrocities, war crimes, violations of international law. He has been unwilling to do the most basic of those. And there's simply no question at this point that the laws of war have been egregiously violated. They're being violated right now, as I stand here. When I was in southern Israel, we could look just 2 kilometers away and see the smoke rising from Gaza as we were there. This war is ongoing, and yet President Biden seems very, you know, he's quite willing to use these terms of condemnation when these crimes are being carried out by America's adversaries. But as I wrote, when it comes to America's friends and allies, he has a different standard. And I think that is corrosive to the very idea of international law.
And then you have the House of Representatives in the U.S. voting last week to sanction the International Criminal Court in protest at its arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former Defense Secretary Gallant. This was Democrats joining with Republicans in this vote.
Yeah.
Matt, you talk about Democrats now becoming the party of war.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I was talking, I think, about in that piece, I was referring to the way that Vice President Harris campaigned, not just about Vice President Harris, because obviously she was, you know, holding up the Biden administration's record and essentially had to run on that. So she carried the weight of you know, a number of policies, including Gaza. But even if you look at the way she campaigns, starting at the convention and then on, highlighting national security bona fides, guaranteeing that she would oversee the most, quote, lethal military in the world, she really seemed to be leaning in to a kind of, you know, militarist status quo, leaving that space open for Donald Trump essentially to run as an anti-war candidate. This is something no one should believe. Donald Trump is certainly not an anti-war candidate. If you look at his record, if you look at the actual things he did when he was president, and yet the fact that that space was left open for him, I think, is a criticism of the Democrats that I was trying to make. But it also shows that this is something that American voters are really thirsty for, someone to give them a different vision of an America that is not constantly at war. And that is something that Democrats really need to start figuring out how to do.
Matt Duss, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President, Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll link to your new essay in The Guardian, headline, Democrats have become the party of war. Americans are tired of it. Thanks for joining us from Jerusalem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As Israel continues its attacks on the Gaza Strip, Qatar's foreign ministry says Israel and Hamas are closer than at any time in the past to reach a ceasefire deal. deal. The news has sparked hope among the nearly 2 million Palestinian families and children who've been displaced by Israel's war and who want nothing more than to rebuild Gaza and return home. Meanwhile, global pressure persists as human rights advocates, healthcare professionals, and others are demanding the release of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of the pediatric Kamel Adwan Hospital in the largest refugee camp in Gaza, Jabalia. He was detained a few weeks ago after Israeli forces raided and shut down that last major hospital in northern Gaza. Israel has not confirmed where it's detaining Dr. Abu Safia, but there have been reports he's being held either at the troubled Sdeh Tayman Israeli prison, which has been plagued by reports of gruesome abuses, including torture and sexual violence against Palestinians in custody, or at the Ofa prison. Dr. Abu Safia's son, Elias, spoke to Al Jazeera Monday about what he knows about his father's whereabouts and condition.
We had few information and not official at all regarding our father. Some of people who have been recently released just say something about my father, and they told that he has been tortured severely by the Israelis and he was transferred to another prison. This morning the lawyer Yusuf Al-Manam told us that he is in Ofer prison and there is a visit could be expected sometime this month. The lawyer has not been allowed to visit him for the second successive times, and my father will be there until at least the 13th of February. We have been told that by Dr. Yusuf Al-Manama, the lawyer. Some local and international lawyer have been also involved in this. They are following his case, and they told us until now there are no official charges at all, and he has not been investigated till now.
Dr. Abu Safia's son, Elias, speaking to Al Jazeera about the conditions that his father is being held in. For more, we go to Chicago, where we're joined by Dr. John Kaler, a retired pediatrician, volunteered in Gaza twice since the beginning of last year, collaborated with Dr. Hussam Abu Safia to establish a feeding center at Kamel Adwan Hospital in last April. He co-founded the medical humanitarian aid group Med Global. Welcome to Democracy Now, Doctor. Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us the latest. At first, it wasn't clear where Dr. Abu Safia is. We see these horrifying images of him walking through the rubble as he's summoned by the Israeli military. Kamel Adwan, the well-known pediatric hospital. Explain what you know at this point.
Well, I'm sorry to thank you for having me, first of all, but I'm sorry to say that we really don't know much more than has been stated. On December 27th, after the third round of attacks on Kamel Adwan starting back in 2023, after the third round where the hospital was actually destroyed, Dr. Abu Safia was taken into custody. It was a horrible picture, but it was also a picture of unbelievable bravery. We also have Dr. Abu Safia would be the first to say that his position is no better than any of the other healthcare workers that have been detained. There's been 500 healthcare workers that have been killed. There are still at least 250 doctors in detention. We ourselves, Med Global, have eight of our healthcare workers in detention. Dr. Abu Safia is the most prominent, and obviously we're here to talk about him because he is the shining light with regards to all that is good about and noble about our profession in Gaza.
So if you can talk about the global response and the significance of Kamel Adwan. We were speaking with the renowned poet Mossab Abu Toha, who just made it out of Gaza recently. And he talked about how this was the place he would take his children to. And what's happened to that hospital and how Dr. Abu Safia stood up for the medical staff, the people who were being arrested.
Sure. First, let me talk about the hospital. When we started our project, Med Global, in 2019. It was in the form of capacity building and resiliency building. Capacity building done by education. Kamal at One Hospital was the pediatric hub that would feed the tertiary care hospital, the most significant hospital in Gaza, namely Shifa. We were in the process of helping train pediatricians, helping train other healthcare personnel, helping staff, and supply Shifa. That was the plan. After October 2023, that plan was no longer operative. Shifa was destroyed. Everyone had to abandon it. Dr. Abu Safia, stood alone in keeping Kamal Adwan Hospital open. There was his bravery stood out. He kept the hospital open and kept the hospital functioning for pediatrics. And actually, as things moved on into 2024, they needed to expand their services beyond pediatrics because it became one of the only hospitals serving Jabalia refugee camp and serving the north. So it didn't just deal with pediatrics, it expanded its services.
The response to what's happening to all of these doctors, like Dr. Borsch, who was found naked and dead at one of the prisons, I believe at Ofer Prison, where it has been mentioned. You heard Dr. Abu Safia's son saying he believes he's at Ofer. That was reported in May.
Yes. Yeah. No one knows for sure. Well, I mean, he hasn't had his moment in court. It's been delayed at least twice. We are trying in all of our capacities to find out not just where he is, but to see him and to hopefully get him released. Any of the hostage deals that are on the table need to deal directly also with the healthcare workers and the other Palestinians, the 9,000 Palestinians that are held as prisoner. I'd like to say this about Dr. Abu Safia, though. When I was with him in March, he told me three things. One spoke to his basic humanness, which was that he was very happy that I was there. I brought some minimal supplies. We were permitted to go north. We were one of the first international groups that were permitted to go north. And we brought minimal supplies, those things that we could put into an SUV. But he received them as if they were manna from heaven. He was very sad that we needed to set up a nutrition stabilization center, but very proud and very happy that it would be done at Kamal Adwan Hospital. So there was his basic humanness. The second thing was that his just friendship. I was going back in May to spend a month there helping establish the nutrition stabilization center. I'm a pediatrician also, so I'd be able to also work in the hospital. So he was very happy that I would be coming back. I would meet his family. And third, though, and most important for this discussion, is he told me directly that there were two things he would absolutely not do. He would, first of all, not abandon his hospital. And the second, and even most important to that, he would not abandon his colleagues and or his patients. And these are acts of bravery and acts of humility. These are the components that all real heroes characterize. And he is, we overuse that term, and we've overused it a lot in the past decade. He is a true hero. He's not a heroic on the level of Viktor Frankl. He's heroic on the level of Mandela, Barghouti. All of them manifest these two traits.
And in the midst of all this, he lost his son. As he remained
for
in Gaza.
For all of this, his son was killed. He himself was wounded. He was abducted, arrested. And then finally, his mom even died. These are things that work to humiliate and remove agency. His bravery is a supreme act of resistance. And what no oppressor will tolerate is that level of resistance. Remember, this was the third time since October 23 that Kamal Adwan was attacked. He stood alone each time defending it and keeping it open. Finally, there was direct destruction of the hospital itself. He was called. Finally, the doctors were arrested. Patients were removed. The hospital was attacked and pretty much burned. And you see that unbelievable picture of him walking up in his white coat, up a hill of destruction to a tank waiting for him, and he walking into the tank, greeting his captors. This is a man who has a level of humanity way beyond anything that I could ever hope for.
Dr. Kaler, we want to end this segment.
I am honored to call him friend.
We want to end this segment with Dr. Abu Safia in his own words.
I always say the situation requires one to stand by our people's side and not run away from it. Gaza is our homeland, our mother, our beloved, and everything to us. Gaza deserves all of this steadfastness and deserves all of the sacrifices. It is not just about Gaza, but we deserve to be a people that deserves freedom, just like every other people on earth. I think the occupation wants us to get out and for us to ask them to get us out so they can publicly say that the healthcare system is the one asking to leave, and that it wasn't them who asked us to, but we are aware of that. But we will not leave, God willing, from this place, as I said, for as long as there are humanitarian services to be provided to our people in the northern Gaza Strip.
That was Dr. Abu Safia in a video produced by Sotiris. He is now in Israeli custody. People around the world are demanding his release. I want to thank Dr. John Kaler, retired pediatrician, co-founder of MedGlobal, who's volunteered in Gaza, worked with Dr. Abu Safia to establish a feeding center at Dr. Abu Safia's hospital, the pediatric Kamal Adwan Hospital. When we come back, the incarcerated firefighters that are fighting the flames in Los Angeles. Stay with us. Hills on Fire by Rosalie. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As Los Angeles braces for more high winds that could bring what's been described as explosive fire growth, firefighting crews continue to battle the Palisades and Eaton fires and other smaller blazes. At least 24 people have been killed. Dozens are still missing. Nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters have been deployed to help contain the fires, typically earning as little as between $5.80 to $10.24 a day. Popular Twitch streamer Hassan Piker spoke to several incarcerated firefighters working in the area.
The cops treat us like but here we get better treatment, right? They talk to us like humans. They talk to us like humans. We got a job. We're underpaid, but we got a job.
Yeah,
you feel me? And then the community comes out and shows us all kinds of love. We never received that growing up. We never received that kind of love, that kind of recognition for anything we've done. So now doing this kind of stuff and all this love coming, that's life changing for a lot of guys. That's all they'd be needing is a little bit of recognition.
For more, we go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Carrie Blankinger, investigative journalist with the LA Times, previously reported on the criminal justice system for the Marshall Project. Her new piece for the LA Times is headlined, How You Can Help the Incarcerated Firefighters Battling LA Wildfires. She co-wrote a Marshall Project piece headlined, Incarcerated Firefighters Do Risky, Low-Pay Work. Many say it's the best job behind bars. Her memoir is Corrections in about her own time in prison. Carrie, we spent time out with the incarcerated firefighters years ago. You recognize them in their orange jumpsuits. They're making between $5 and $10, not an hour, but a day. Explain what you know about their situation right now.
Well,
as you mentioned, the pay sounds low, but this is actually one of the better paying jobs in prison. And that's why it's actually a really sort of coveted job. So even though it's this grueling manual labor, and they're out there right now, 888 of them, fighting the fires in Palisades and out in Altadena, despite the risks and the seemingly low pay, this is still a really coveted job in prison. And as you, as that clip that you played showed, it's something that's also really rewarding for the people that are doing it.
So talk about where they're fighting the fires right now and where exactly they stay, where they work out of, how they get to this point where they can be fighting these fires.
Yeah, so there are 35 fire camps across the state, which is where they live when they're not actively fighting fires. When they are actively fighting fires, then they're located at, at some sort of like make do type camp situation, closer to the actual fire. But the training for the firefighters is about a week of training. It's similar to what, or it's actually the same as what people that are fighting this in the free world would go through to do these same tasks. You asked where. We've only been told that they are fighting the Palisades and Eaton fires. So, the Malibu area fires and the ones in Altadena. We haven't gotten any more specifics. The prison system has not been able to give us any more specifics about like where specifically, or if there are other blazes in the area that they're working on.
Historically, incarcerated firefighters has made up as much as 30% of the California wildfire force. Is that right?
Yeah, the numbers have dwindled, though, over time. There was a point at which there were over 4,000. I think that was around 2005. They're down to about 1,800 now. There'd been some consideration of, in the budget, it was slated to close 5 of the fire camps, although that got taken out of the budget, so those stayed open. But they've been a significant part of the firefighting force, even though their numbers are dwindling.
You yourself, Kerry, had to evacuate. Can you describe your own situation?
Yeah, that was wild. I actually had jury duty that day because despite being a felon in California, you can be called for jury duty. So my first jury duty experience, I was worried all day about what would happen if I had to evacuate while I was at jury duty. And I came back and within an hour, I was scrolling Twitter and saw a report of a fire very close to me. And I looked out the window and the flames were right there and it was less than 2 blocks away. And I had to take I don't have a car. So I had to take whatever I could carry and flee on foot. And I walked a few blocks south to get away from the gridlock and then had someone pick me up. And then a couple days later, went a little bit further to try to get a day or two of clean air in Orange County. And it was really wild to see the disparity. Because I got off the train in Orange County and there were rich people frolicking to the sound of somebody playing Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And the disparity was really jarring. Mm.
Kerry, I wanted to go back to your piece, which is really illuminating. You say legally one of the reasons the state can pay incarcerated firefighters so little for this dangerous and vital work is that under the U.S. and California constitutions, involuntary servitude is permitted as punishment for a crime. You say California voters had the opportunity in November to remove this exemption from the state constitution that would have opened the door to new kinds of legal challenges over working conditions for incarcerated people in the state, but the measure failed, Kerry?
Yes, it did. And I think that was surprising in some ways because there wasn't any particular opposition to it. And a similar measure in Nevada actually passed. So when you look at what you would expect from a bluer state versus a redder state voters, I think that was surprising. But yeah, the Californians decided to keep that on the books.
Do incarcerated firefighters get firefighting jobs when they get out?
This has been such an issue over the past several years. It started getting more attention. In the past 5 years, maybe, because the fact that they have felony convictions has in most cases barred them from being firefighters. They can't get the EMT license. There was a change in state law that took effect in 2021 that allowed for California firefighters with nonviolent convictions to potentially get those convictions expunged and become firefighters in the free world. And that has happened some. It's not widespread, but it is an option now, and it didn't used to be.
Well, Carrie Blickinger, we thank you so much for being with us. We're going to link to both your Marshall Project piece and your piece in the L.A. Times, how you can help the incarcerated firefighters battling L.A. wildfires. Author of the memoir Corrections in Ink, speaking to us from Los Angeles, where she was just recently evacuated. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nduris, Sam Alcock, Tay Marie Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, we are on Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I have a guest here. So I've got Elizabeth Dietrich, who is a PhD student in literary and cultural studies. So one of your main things is studying early modern theater. So I wanted to start us off with a silly question. So what is your favorite Shakespearean insult?
There are some that are straight up insults, like Queen Margaret calling Richard III a toad, saying he's unfit for any place but hell, right? These are kind of straightforward, but I like the ones that are kind of shade in a conversation, sort of like the line, "I do desire that we may be better strangers," which is from As You Like It, a very sort of funny, a lot of humor woven into that particular play. At one point in Hamlet, Polonius says to Hamlet that he's going to take his leave, and Hamlet says that there is no thing that he would more willingly part with than Polonius's company. So these are actually, I think, my favorites, are the sort of sly, situational, conversational insults.
So it's less you egg and more, you know, contextually, that is really brutal.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Let's take it back to more things you have done than random questions. But you've actually spent a while like working in professional theater companies. So can you tell me a little about what you did and what it was like?
Yeah, I've worked at a couple of professional theater companies. Haven't had the privilege of working with any in Pittsburgh yet, but I worked with the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, which is in Michigan, surprisingly, perhaps, and a professional theater in Chicago that is now closed called the American Theater Company. With the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, I had a double role as both a dramaturg and a company manager. And then in Chicago, I was in the education department. So a bit of a different sort of thing, less about putting the plays on and more about the outreach endeavors that particular theater did.
Before we go any further, I know a lot of people have asked me what a dramaturg is as an English student, and I don't really know. So can you kind of tell me what that's like?
Yeah. So my first answer is it kind of depends on not only the theater, but the play. It's a very flexible role. My professor of dramaturgy at my undergraduate institution said on the first day of dramaturgy class that the dramaturg is the smartest person in the room. which is, of course, no shade to actors, directors, and all kinds of other brilliant people. But I think what he was going for is the dramaturg sees a picture that is sort of bigger and deeper than the others involved who might be focused on staging the play, on enacting one of the characters, or one of these sort of more focused roles. So in my capacity as a dramaturg for the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, I did do a little bit of research, but a lot of that for that particular festival was also done by the directors. So I would occasionally look up sort of random questions that the actors might have. I remember doing a deep dive for the actress playing Viola in Twelfth Night, and she was sort of stuck on one of her lines. So she asked me, what does Viola mean when she says that her sister, or she's sort of impersonating Cesario, so she's talking about herself, but she's sort of in the third person, that this woman died of a green and yellow melancholy. So I did this sort of deep dive for this actress into early modern humors and bile, and we really got to sort of dig into, you know, is this a metaphorical sickness or a real sickness? So these kind of deep dive questions. But I also did a lot of promotional writing in the forms of newsletters.